Hello and welcome to our program, The Advocates, on WVOX 1460 AM. I'm Richard J. Garfunkel. I'm the host of this weekly forum. We're on a little bit late today, but we have a wonderful program coming live from New Rochelle, the Queen City, located on the Long Island Sound, and it can be heard live streaming on www.wvox.com. One can also call directly the station at 914-636-0110. We encourage all of our listeners to call, but please stay germane to our topic today. Usually we talk about public policy, and we're going to try to get in a little bit about the business of baseball today, but our special guest is Mr. Ralph Branca, who grew up in Mount Vernon, New York, graduated from A.B. Davis High School and New York University. He's a former starting pitcher in the Major League Baseball from 1944 through 1956. Branca played for the Brooklyn Dodgers, Detroit Tigers for a short period, and even, I think we call it a cup of coffee, maybe that's the wrong term, with the Yankees in 1954. He batted and threw right-handed. Ralph was known as a very good starter during his years in Brooklyn. He debuted on June 12, 1944 with the Brooklyn Dodgers and put up a 3.04 ERA in 109 innings. And in 1945, his rookie year, he was pretty good. Three-time All-Star. He won 80 games for the Dodgers with a career high of 21 wins in 1947, which was what we all know is the golden age of baseball in New York. Mr. Branca, who spent over 50 years in the insurance industry, is affiliated with a company that I know quite well, Strategies for Wealth in Rybrook, New York. Also today is a very good friend of mine, is Alan Rosenberg, is here with us. He'll serve as our guest panelist. Alan is another native Mount Vernonite, also who graduated from A.B. Davis and New York University. He's a longtime CPA who has offices in both New York City and Scarsdale. In fact, I think he does work for WVOX here. Is that correct, Alan?
That's true.
And he is an avid sports fan and memorabilia collector. Meanwhile, the mission of the Advocates is to bring to the public differing views on current public policy issues. Public policy, therefore, is what we as a nation legally and traditionally follow. Over the years, the public policy of the United States has changed and been modified greatly. As an example, free public education is the public policy of the United States. Of course, I want to welcome Mr. Ralph Branca, a witness to and a participant in baseball's golden age in New York baseball, obviously, from 1947 to 1957. It could be a year or two either side, and my old and dear friend Alan Rosenberg. We all grew up in Mount Vernon, New York, our neighboring city to New Rochelle. All three of us went to A.B. Davis High School. All three of us played sports in high school, and all three of us are lifetime residents of Westchester County. Ralph Branca was in uniform at Ebbets Field on that historic day, April 15th, 1947, when Jackie Robinson took the field, broke the baseball's unwritten color barrier, and changed America. Therefore, Ralph, the first question in my mind, and I'm sure what is on the mind of all New Yorkers, is what was Jackie Robinson really like?
Jackie was a feisty, fiery competitor. Probably the best competitor I've ever played with or against. If the occasion demanded it, Jackie rose to that occasion, produced. Jackie was not a guy who was into civil rights movements at the time. In fact, there was no civil rights movement when he started. And so Jackie was thrust into the position of being the leader of the race. And that was extra pressure on him, besides being the first black to play baseball.
And he was not a youngster when he came up.
Jackie was 28 years old. He was born in 1919. And so Jackie was such a great athlete that he was able to compete, because I say this many times, he was a better track star because he jumped 27-plus feet in a broad jump. He ran track. His brother Matt ran in the Olympics in 1936. And Jackie was all conference in basketball and football out in UCLA. I mean, I think baseball was his worst sport, but he was able to will himself, because he was such a great athlete, to produce. And he ended up being Rookie of the Year. He had 297 his first year. But he did it under adverse conditions because, he got taunted and, jibed at, anything you could do.
To get him off his game.
I mean, they really were on his case because he was the first black. And that was prevalent. I don't really remember much about Boston being that way, but Philadelphia, Pittsburgh were bad, Cincinnati, St. Louis. Chicago, I don't really remember being too drastic, being on his case. But he had to listen to all that nonsense and still perform and still keep his concentration.
Well, you know, it's interesting because the history of the era was that it wasn't the stars that feared the black ball player. It was basically the 22nd, 23rd, 24th guy on the team. In the sense is they knew that the black baseball, as we know it today and as it was known, Negro baseball in those days, had enough stars in Negro baseball that if you took the three or four guys off each team in the Negro baseball team, they were not going to eliminate the Ted Williams or the Bob Fellers or the Mel Ott's or the Ralph Kiner's. They weren't going to eliminate those guys. They were going to eliminate the four or five guys on the end of the bench. And that's where it seemed all the stir-up was, that I think it was almost as much economic as race.
Well, it was economic, and you made a valid point, you know, about the guys who were hangers-on, who were not starters. But the other thing was, guys from the South, they had grown up with this set of mores, you know, and this is how they lived, and this was taken for granted that blacks were inferior, and they had toilets of blacks only, that drinking fountains black sure. only, blacks rode the back of the bus. So they grew up with that mentality.
And St. Louis was a Jim Crow town, and you know, no question about
right.
it. And nobody played baseball in the South in those days. And spring training, I mean, there's a lot of stories about what he had to endure in, you know, down in Vero Beach.
Yeah, well, I don't know if the blacks played baseball down there, but yeah, there's a lot of good athletes, a lot of good major leaguers came from the South
sure.
at that
oh,
time.
Yeah.
I would say that if you looked at the rosters, you'd see that it came from the South and from California, where the weather's conducive to playing baseball more in a year than you do up north.
You know, as a young man growing up in Mount Vernon during the Depression, you were a star athlete at A.B. Davis High School. Both Alan and I grew up 20 years later in a much more prosperous era. I know Alan rooted for the Giants, and I was a Yankee fan. What was it like in those days, and whom did you root for? What was
Well, and I've said this often, two-thirds of the fans were Yankee fans, and I think I grew in a neighborhood that was a mixed neighborhood, but it was mostly, I'm going to say, Italian descent. And with DiMaggio and Lazzari and Crosetti, maybe that made them Yankee fans. But I'd say two-thirds of the people in Mount Vernon were Yankee fans. One-third were Giant fans. And only one guy was a Brooklyn Dodger fan. His name was Kenny Hale. And, you know, we played ball together. And so I was fortunate enough. I had two older brothers, brother Ed and a brother Jules. And they were like second fathers to the last three born of my mother and father. We're all boys. My brother John, who most everybody in this area knows about, he was the
boxing commissioner of the
boxing
state,
commissioner.
Assemblyman.
He was an assemblyman. He was a teacher at Edison High, and he was a recreation commissioner
sure.
where I think all the people in Mount Vernon truly
oh, yeah.
loved him.
Oh, he's a great guy.
And my brother Paul, a little younger than me, and then my youngest brother Al. And so my brother Jules and Ed were the guys who provided us with gloves and an interest in sports. And Jules was a very good baseball player, you know, sandlot player. Ed wasn't that good, but he played softball, and he was good at softball, but he just wasn't that good at baseball. And they took us to the games. They bought us our first gloves. So, and I remember pitching to my brother Jules in the driveway of my yard, you know, same as John. And so
were you a Yankee or a Giant fan?
I was a Giant fan.
Oh, Giant. How about you, Alan? You know, you grew up in Mount Vernon. Your father was your people go way back in Mount Vernon to the turn of the century, the century before. How did you become a Giant fan, and what, you know, in that sense?
Well, I was really a fan of Monty Irvin, the great black player. And this was 1951 when I was 5 years old and was following the sport, even though we didn't have much on television in those days, but we had the newspapers. And my brother, who was 3.5 years older, said to me, "Wait till you see Willie Mays. You're gonna change." And I love Willie Mays, and he was right. I became a Willie Mays fan. Of course, my dad was a Giant fan,
And my father was a Giant fan. He grew up in he was from Manhattan, He then moved up to Kelly Street in the Bronx. My father was born in 1904, and he could talk to you about Iron Man Joe McGinnity. Now, that's a name from way back. Ross Youngs, Christy Mathewson, Big Six. So my father grew up. So your father's a little younger than mine.
Yes, he was. Of course, my dad loved Babe Ruth and always would talk about Babe Ruth, but for some reason he was a Giant fan.
Well, you know, he's in the 20s. The Giants were really the New York team of the 20s. I mean, the Yankees won when Ruth came down from the Red Sox. But the Giants from, let's say, 20 to 37, you know, the Giants won a lot.
Carl Hubbell, sure, Mellott.
And Mellott, Carl Hubbell.
The great first baseman.
Bill Terry, Schumacher.
Right.
You know, and because of being a Giant fan, you know. And Hank Lieber, they got from the Cubs, and JoJo Moore, and Travis Jackson. So, I knew all of those guys, and I think that you could be a Giant fan in that era. But the Yankees came on in the 30s, and from 1936 to 1950, I'm going to say 58, they really dominated baseball, not only American League,
but
baseball.
Yeah.
They were on the All-Star teams, and they won so many pennants that they dominated the National League in winning the pennants, winning the World Series.
You know, Ralph, you were signed virtually right out of high school as a young kid. In fact, I read that you had one of your parents sign for you. You know, is that correct?
That's correct.
And could you tell us about your impression going to the locker room as a teenager and first walking out into the sunlight, Ebbets Field? That must have been very unique to.
Well, you know, you walk into Ebbets Field and it's a huge open area. I mean, it wasn't like lockers against all the walls, sitting out on the wall and big air. Their lockers were somewhere in the center because they didn't have enough wall space. So they had locker rooms in the lockers in the center of the room. And, you know, I walked in, and the clubhouse man said to me, "Are you a superstitious kid?" And I said, "No," and he gave me number 13.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it was, and, you know, being in there and looking at guys that, you know, because I was a Giant fan, and on Memorial Day, I'm rooting for the Giants, and 6 days later, I'm a Dodger. So it was a little strange, you know, go from being a Giant fan to becoming a Dodger.
Now, they were drawing. You remember, you know, all of us know that in the post-war era, post-World War II, the big leagues had the greatest period of affluence that had ever been seen. All the records, I mean, Cleveland drew, 2.6 million? The Yankees drew 2.3. The Dodgers in a bandbox was 1.7. I think the Giants drew about 1.8. And everybody, all the attendance records held for like 15 or 20 years after that. You must have had a large crowd at Ebbets Field every day, I would gather.
Well, I think, you know, the influx of Jackie and then Roy Campanella and Newcomb, we drew a lot of blacks to the park. And because we were competitive, and Brooklyn was special. I mean, it was the fans are very, very special. The ballpark was small and intimate. If you went to the game, you were right on top of the action. And it was like Brooklyn's the second-class citizens because they basically, way back in 1850, they were the farmland for Manhattan / New York. And so people lived there and worked in Manhattan, New York.
Right.
So they had an underdog tone to it. So when the Dodgers finally got good in the 40s, after struggling, they only won in 16 and 1920, these fans came out of the woodwork to be Dodger fans, and we did draw well. But I think the black influence and the success of the team all added up.
Well, it was, you know, it's interesting. By 1947, at the tender age of 21, you were already a veteran entering in your fourth year in the big leagues. And that remarkable pennant-winning season, you had your greatest in your career, obviously. You won 21 games. You had a great ERA of 2.67, and that was a heavy-hitting era, and you played in a bandbox. And for a guy to pitch half his games and have 2.67 ERA, you know, basically you were on the top of the world, I'd feel. What was it like being 21, money in your pocket, a baseball star, good-looking, and playing practically in your hometown? This must have been a pretty heady days for you.
Money in my pocket all made noise. It jingled. I worked for Ricky. I was making $6,500, which was, to Ricky, a lot of money. Me, it wasn't. you know. But, you know, I was so involved in winning and pitching. And actually, I would start on a Monday, relieve on Wednesday, and start on Friday. And I had 36 starts, which I led the league in starts. And I completed 15 games and relieved seven times. But when I look at the seven times, I don't know how many times I warmed up and was ready to go in if the guy gave up a base hit or walked the guy. And he got the guy out, so I didn't go in. But, you know, as you mentioned, I pitched in a bandbox. But, you know, it was a hitter's park, and people don't take that into consideration when they talk about the great hitting Dodger teams, because it was a bandbox.
No, no question about it. It's interesting how you say that, because baseball, you know, you take a look at a field like Forbes Field. Tough to hit a home run in Forbes Field. Tough to hit a home run in Griffith Stadium. You know, those were big ballparks.
You know, in Forbes Field, when Kiner came there, and then he got Hank Greenberg, they put a bullpen out in left field from the foul line, I'm going to say, to possibly straight left field, and it was called Greenberg Gardens.
Right.
And when Hank retired, it became Kiner's Corner. So, and it was like 457 to center field, same as Yankee Stadium. Yankee Stadium was 457, 461.
Right.
Big ballpark. The left field line was 314, but went away rapidly because where the bullpen is, which is straight left, it was 402 on one side and 415 on the other. That's where John Fito made the catch.
The great power alleys.
Right. Yeah. And then, you know, and right field was, it was left-handed hitter's park. 296 down the line, 344 to straight right with like a four-foot fence.
You know, it's interesting. That 1947 World Series, many people talk about as one of the greatest World Series ever played. I think the 1960 World Series, which was a remarkable World Series, sort of, it may have eclipsed it. But 47 had the Bevins game. Now, he's pitching a no-hitter, and you're on the bench, you know, watching or in the bullpen. What do you think about Bevins and that? That must have been pretty exciting.
It wasn't exactly.
No, he had nine walks.
He walked nine guys. And I have to marvel, he walked nine guys, and he still had a no-hitter.
Right.
I mean, you know, that's like nine base hits, nine men on base. Instead of pitching to 27 guys, now he's going to pitch to 36. But that was a very, very interesting game because we were losing 2-1, which people don't think a no-hitter is a shutout normally. But John Frieda was on first base, and he stole second, a very vital play, you know. And they walked Pete Reiser, and, you know, the norm is that you don't walk the winning run on.
Right.
Well, they walked Pete Reiser, who had a terrible ankle, couldn't run worth a nickel, and they put in Eddie Mixes to run for him. And, of course, Lavagetto then hit the ball off the right field wall, the fastball high away, and it bounced and hit Henrik in the chest. He picked it up, and Mixes could absolutely fly. And he was like 20, 25 feet behind John Frieda because, you know, he was running two outs. And we ended up winning the game 3-2.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. I think Lavagetto and John Frieda, that was the last games they played. I don't think they played after
right.
that.
No, wait a minute. I have to go further on.
Go ahead.
So now we're in 1950, and we're playing Philadelphia, and we have Cal Abrams on second base, and sitting on a bench is Eddie Mixes. Hmm. And Shotten, as usual, fell asleep. I don't know what he was doing. You know, terrible manager, perpetrated on the poor people of Brooklyn and that great Brooklyn ball club. But he was a non-entity. And so he should have put Mixes in to run. Because now Snyder hits a line drive to center field, and Ashburn's looking for a bunt, so he's playing shallow. And he catches the ball shallow. And Cal kind of ran flat-footed and made a wide turn. He got thrown out by like 20 feet because the throw was up the line. I said, if we had Mixes in, he scores. I know he scores. Now we win the game, and now we go into a playoff. We could have won in 1950 because, you know, we had a good ball club.
You know, it's interesting. My beautiful wife asked me the other day that what ball player managers wear a uniform, mm-hmm. and she asked me if any manager didn't wear a uniform. I said, well, the great Connie Mack dressed in a, you know, regular street clothes. I think he had his boater on, too. And Bert Shotten dressed in street clothes.
Yeah, well, Bert had a stroke, and he couldn't really use his left arm. So I guess it was tough for him to get dressed into uniform.
Oh, that's interesting. So that do you know of any other managers who...
No, those were the main two,
right.
Sure.
You know, Alan, you grew up as a Giant fan, and your interest and my interest overlapped the end of Ralph's career. Tell us what your impressions of this great intercity rivalry and how you felt. How did you, as a sports fan?
Well, you know, Brooklyn seemed very far away. And I guess Ralph made mention of that when he said most of Mount Vernon were Yankee fans and Giant fans. It's such a different world today than it was 50, 60 years ago. So I think that's why we were Giant fans. And we also liked the underdog. The Yankees kept winning and winning, and we liked to come from behind and try to win. And, of course, the Giants won in 51.
Right.
Whoa.
They didn't win.
You got to use a different verb.
They stole it.
well, we'll get into that.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Ralph, all New Yorkers know about the Giant-Dodger rivalry of that era, the greatest in baseball. And as I said off mic, that it's much greater than the Yankee Red Sox. I mean, that was never in the league.
Well, it's much greater because they live
right
in the same house. You got a Yankee fan, a Red Sox fan, same neighbor, neighbors next door. You know, but here in Brooklyn, I mean, it was, you know, every neighborhood had Dodger fans and Giant fans and Yankee fans. And
they were on top of each other.
Or be disputing who was the best center fielder, who's this, who's that.
Right. What was it like for you, and what was your impression of Leo DeRocher? Now, that is a famous name for the old-timers. You know, I think he was your original Dodger manager.
He was the original.
And then he was suspended for associating, they said,
with gamblers,
George Raft. And you faced the great Willie Mays as 22 times each season. I asked you this before. How great was he, and was he better than Jackie Robinson?
No.
Wow.
No. First of all, I'll go to your first question, Leo. Leo was a very, very good manager. And I was a young kid, and I would sit on the bench. Brooklyn had a bench that was divided. The steps came up, and like the manager's side was by the water cooler. And he said, we only had two coaches. And he would sit there. And then I would listen to him, and he'd say, well, if I bring up so-and-so to hit, they'll bring in so-and-so to pitch. Then I have this guy and that guy on the bench, and they have this guy left to pitch. And he would have, like, make chart, like, six or seven moves, just like a chess game.
Right.
So Leo was very, very good.
Yeah.
He went to the Giants. He got a little bit Hollywood, you know. And I think he really spoiled Willie. And Willie had great natural abilities. I mean, you know, he's young. He's 21 years old. He could do all five things, you know, hit, run field, hit with powers, you know, throw, you know, well, I mean, I'll go hit with power, run field, and throw.
I'm pretty sure.
And he was a five-tool man.
No question. So our audience is aware today of our form. We're talking right through. We started a little late, so we're probably not going to have a real break. We're on WVOX 1460 AM radio, live streaming at www.wvox.com, and this is The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel. My guest, Mr. Ralph Branca, one of the star pitchers on Brooklyn's own Boys of Summer, the Dodgers of Ebbets Field, and our panelist is Alan Rosenberg, a fellow Mount Vernonite, as Ralph and I are, a lover of baseball like me. Ralph, the post-war years saw record attendance all over the major leagues. The Dodgers played in a small ballpark and broke all their own attendance records in those days. But as the 50s rolled on, baseball attendance started a long period of declining interest. And before long, old-time franchises like the Browns, St. Louis Browns, Philadelphia A's, the Boston Braves were forced to move. Why did that magic wear off, and what happened to baseball after the boom of the 1940s?
The thing called television. Television changed the whole world, not only the sports world, but the whole world. I mean, you go back into the 30s and 40s, and maybe we had six or eight hockey teams. There was no pro basketball. There was no pro track. Golf was nothing. I mean, who went to see a golf tournament until the big old television came into being? So television now went out and indoctrinated people into different sports. And, you know, Arnie Palmer really was the savior of golf his charisma. Then he had basketball with the Celtics, a big team, and the Knicks being tough. You know, the Celtics had Bill Russell and Bob
Cousy,
et cetera, Tommy Heinsohn. And track, you could watch pro track. Even horse racing is prevalent on the weekends, especially Triple Crown. Tennis all over the world. You see tennis now. So baseball had people that were going after the same bucks they were going after. Yeah, so they had competition.
So, right.
So I think all of these sports kind of got into baseball's pocket.
Sure, no doubt that with the great football game between the Colts and the Giants in 58, which is the modern era of football, that television brought all of a sudden all these sports to people. They didn't have to go out to the neighborhood baseball game or listen to it on the radio. No doubt. Our guest this afternoon is Mr. Ralph Branca, a star pitcher on the star-studded Brooklyn Dodgers, many Hall of Famers. Alan Rosenberg is our panelist today. I want to ask Ralph, and I know the audience is probably very interested in this, and he's been asked this a million times. If we didn't speak to this, we wouldn't be of service, of course, about the famous shot heard around the world, how it impacted his legacy. Is he bitter over the fact that is now generally accepted the Giants, who went down the stretch 37-7, were cheating? So, you know, I want to ask Ralph his thoughts on the famous Bobby Thompson home run and the fact the Giants were illegally stealing the catcher's signs and relaying them to their batters. What's your thoughts on that, Ralph?
Well,
I know you've had the question a zillion times.
And I come up with the same answer. The most despicable act in the history of the game. Mm. The game is played between the white lines. If you steal the signs between the white lines, I have an opportunity to find out. I'm suspicious. I will be looking for stuff. But to hook up telescope, hook up a buzzer system, buzz the bullpen in the dugout, how are we supposed to detect that? And they did it on the road. Sal Evaz has told me they stole them in Chicago, St. Louis, Cincinnati, and even in Boston. So that's why they were able to. Because I said, how did they go? How did they win on the road? Well, they still stole them on the road.
Yeah.
You know? And so I said, what about Ebbets Field? He said, no, because if they ever got discovered, they figured they might be killed.
I don't doubt it.
Well, and to me, rightfully so.
Right. Ralph,
but, you know what? It's part of the game. It's not a part of the game. No. I mean, the Cubs, the White Sox, Cleveland, all that scoreboards in center field, they never hooked up a buzzer system. And they had brought binoculars to see it. But all those scoreboards were directly in center field. They used a flashlight, and Cleveland used a unique system. A guy sat in the right corner with white socks. He put a one for a fastball, two for a curve, and wiggling for the changeup. But, you know, if you daydream and you see this in the dugout, you say, whoa, wait a minute, what's going on here, you know?
Right.
Ralph, some of the people have said that even if a Bobby Thompson or anyone else knew what pitch was going to be thrown, of course, it's a great advantage, but wouldn't it still be difficult to hit these pitches knowing what they were? Or do you think...
Hitting a baseball is still the toughest feat in sports. And but if you know what's coming, it's a big, big advantage. Right. Just go watch batting practice and see how many line drives they hit, because they're not throwing 90 miles an hour, but they do hit line drives and pound the ball. Just look at the home run hitting contest when they wait for certain pitches. You know, he wants the ball led a high over the middle of the plate so he can extend his arm. So when you know what's coming, it's big. And the whole thing boils down to if they stole one game, just one game that they shouldn't have won. They won a game 15-14. You shouldn't win that game.
No. Right. Of course, that was...
Now you don't have a playoff. And right. I look back and I think, the Dodgers starting four was a pretty good starting four. You had Newcomb. Preacher Rowe went 22-3, Erskine and myself. And unfortunately, Clyde King was a bullpen guy, and he got hurt. And we had Clem LeBine, but somehow he got in Charlie's doghouse because he wanted to come to a set position with the bases loaded in 3-2, which is the right thing to do when Charlie wanted to wind up. Mm-hmm. So Clem, being a little hard-headed but doing the right thing, came to a set position, hung a curve, and the guy hit a grand slam. So Clem didn't get in the doghouse. He went under the doghouse. And Charlie didn't use him like the last 6-7 weeks.
So
till the second game of the playoff.
To frame this for our audience, people should remember and know that the Giants made this remarkable run the last 2 months of the season. They were 13.5 games behind in August. It was always rumored. People talked about it. Something was strange. And, of course, it came out in a fellow named Joshua Prager. He wrote a book called The Echoing Green, The Untold Story of Bobby Thompson, Ralph Branca, and the Shot Heard Around the World. This is the most famous event I believe, wasn't this regarded as the most famous sporting event in history in the 20th century up there? Didn't they have ESPN? Somebody did this?
It like depends on who's doing it. Right. Sporting News said it was number one. New York Post, number one event in baseball. Only Major League Baseball with one of their, well, mental midgets, I'm going to call them. They had a contest to determine which was the most memorable moment in that century. Mm-hmm. And he showed Cal Ripken. They did it for about 2.5 months. They had Cal Ripken on in like 90% of the times, and they never showed Thompson hitting a home run till like 5 days to go in this thing. So he was gearing for Cal Ripken. Right. And it's not the most memorable moment. It took him 17 years. That may be a moment in the eternity or life of this earth or the planets or the universe. But it's not a moment.
Right. Obviously, when Gehrig broke the record, which was like 1,130 by some unknown guy. I remember the guy. I can't think of him at the moment. But that wasn't important. Of course, Gehrig's record stayed a long time, but you're 100% correct. It's a cumulative record. It was going to happen. When Hank Aaron, if he played enough, he would have hit his 715th home run. 61st home run may not have happened. But it's interesting that, as dramatic to our audience, this is the greatest drama. I mean, this is the third game of a three-game playoff. This is after a pennant chase that everyone thinks is legitimate. Let's face it, this is one of the great pennant runs of all time. And most people who understand this understand the remarkable uniqueness of this. And here we have Ralph Branca is in the... How close can you get? I mean,
Also, if you remember that game, the way they even won it, where the Dodgers needed 6 outs to win that particular game, and the Giants started to get a couple of men on base. I'm sure Ralph knows and remembers.
Newcomb struck out the side in the 8th inning.
Right.
And then the controversial play is 1 out and a man on first. And Hodges should have been playing back. You know, he wants to steal, he's going to steal, but they're losing 4-1. He's not going to steal in case he trips and gets thrown out. So Hodges should have been playing back, and he was playing a step and a half behind the runner. And the ball was hit to his right and went off his glove, and Jackie was going left and went behind Jackie. Had Gilly been playing back, he catches the ball, goes to second base, at least a force out, and it's 2 outs. And if Newcomb covers first, it could have been a double play. And Newcomb would have covered
it's
first.
It's such a game of inches. And there, you know, Ralph has just explained how much baseball. I'm not sure today it's such a game of inches. I think the quality of the game has deteriorated quite a bit. And we're going to talk about that. I just want to break for a moment and remind our audience about one of our sponsors. If you're looking for a licensed residential care facility for your frail, elderly loved one, consider the Greenbrier Adult Home, located in Millbrook in Dutchess County, New York. Greenbrier has a loving family atmosphere and is situated within a beautiful park-like 4-acre setting about 50 minutes from White Plains and not far from the Taconic Parkway, which we all know Franklin Roosevelt helped build as governor of New York. Greenbrier Adult Home has set the standard for excellence for the personal elder care in the Hudson Valley for over 40 years. The home also has a highly regarded program for elderly veterans. Please contact Dottie or Brenda, the administrators, for more information. The phone number is 845-677-9997. Again, the number is 845-677-9997. I want to welcome our audience back to the Advocates on WVOX 1460 AM. Today we're talking to our local baseball hero, Ralph Branca, who starred in baseball and other sports at Mount Vernon's A.B. Davis High School and obviously carved his name and fame on the famous Boys of Summer, the legendary Brooklyn Dodgers in the golden age of baseball. Ralph, you witnessed firsthand some of the greatest ball players to grace American ball fields. You saw legendary stars like Mantle, Mays, Snyder, Musial, Jackie and Frank Robinson, Hank Aaron, Warren Spahn, Ted Williams, Robin Roberts, the great DiMaggio, Rizzuto, Campanella, Baron Score. I mean, we could go on and on. This is a real golden age of talent. Who made the greatest impression on you and why?
You know, I'm going to be prejudiced because I'm going to name 2 Dodgers. I think Jackie Robinson, for what he had to overcome, you know, and he was really bucking against the tide. And for Pee Wee, a boy from Louisville, which was a segregated city, You know, I saw him come over to Jackie from shortstop and put his arm around Jackie in Cincinnati. And the friendship that developed there, that's those two guys made the greatest impression as far as being human beings and really heroes in my book.
Mm. And a lot of people agree with you on that. You know, one of the great names of our time, certainly Alan and I, not as well known today, but most baseball fans will never forget Stan Musial, who was used to wear out right field and Ebbets Field in your day, and he was so successful, one fan named him the man. How did you fare against this perennial all-star?
He was tough, you know, and if you got him out, you got him out, but he didn't strike out, and he was very tough. And he was tough because he hit to all fields. Mm. He didn't just try to pull everything. He hit it the opposite way, and yeah, I know he came into Ebbets Field in a three-game series, and he went 11 for 15. And I proudly say, he only made four outs, and I got him out twice. He only went 2 for 4 against me. So it's he was quite good. A hitter.
Yeah, he was a perennial National League batting champion.
He won the batting championship about 7 times,
right.
Which is probably more than anyone other than Ty Cobb.
Right.
And I believe in Ebbets Field, he batted lifetime approximately 350, which is unheard of.
Yeah, no,
so he really came in, except
not,
against
that's not much above his real lifetime average anywhere else. I have a stat for you. He has 3,600, and let me see, let's say 3,630 hits.
Right. Most of them were in New York.
No. Exactly half on the road and half at home.
Oh, well, that's
1815 on the road and 1815 at home.
Well, so that's remarkable consistency.
And
that's,
he's a great harmonica player.
Well, you know, he started
a ball player. A ball player is good.
You know, in an era, half a generation before you, you know, he started as a pitcher. What do they call him? The Denora Greyhound.
Well, pitcher's always the best athlete.
Right, and he
Babe Ruth, you know, was
right,
a pitcher.
And he's the and amongst the three of us, Babe Ruth is the greatest ball player of all time. Would everybody agree with that?
Right, people don't understand. He has like 2,873 hits. He's only like 127 hits from 3,000 hits, and he has a lifetime average of 342.
And he walked about 2,000 times.
And he pitched the first few years.
Sure, of course. He's a great pitcher.
His pitching record, which I happen to be a Babe Ruth man, 94-46. With a lifetime ERA of 2.28.
Yeah, no, Babe Ruth was, there's nobody like him. So all of our listeners know and should know from 1947 to 57, that's 50 years ago already, hard to believe. A period of 11 years, a New York team won the National League pennant 8 times, the Yankees won the pennant 9 times, the World Series won by a New York team 9 times out of 11 years, but by 1958, the Dodgers and Giants had left town, remarkably left town. With all this success, why did National League Baseball die in New York, Ralph? What was the short-sightedness of these people?
I think the Dodgers wanted a different stadium. They wanted a bigger stadium, more modern stadium with parking. The Giants were not drawing. And, if you're not drawing, you're not making money, you can't compete. And I think that was it. But I think O'Malley's main thrust was to get a new stadium with parking, or he wanted to use all the railroad systems, which is where the New York Nets are going, at Flatbush and Atlantic Avenue. I think there's 7 subway lines and the Long Island Railroad's right there. So I think Moses, who built all the roads, wanted people to use the roads rather than public transportation. So he was adamant about it, and I think Bob Moses chickened out. He let 2 New York teams go, which the great city of New York should never have let those 2 teams go. You know, they do make deals now for teams to move into towns over the years, you know, where they make some kind of tax regulations or they give them some kind of incentive to come and play in that town. So New York was asleep at the switch.
You know, we don't have the great stars, I feel, in baseball today as we used to. I just don't think they have the names. Do you think that the youngsters that today look up to the current stars the way you in your day and our generation did? You think
it's
the same? Oh, you do.
Yeah, they don't know any better. You know, when you talk about baseball and you watch what's going on and they talk about it, and I say, when I played, there was 400 big leaguers. You know how many minor leaguers there were?
Oh, God, must have been 2,500.
20,000.
Oh,
20 to 22,000
wow.
Minor leaguers. So 1 out of 50 guys playing baseball for a living was in the big leagues.
Wow.
Today you got 750 big leaguers, and there's probably about 5,000 minor leaguers. So I'm going to say one out of eight guys playing baseball is in the big leagues.
So it's different talent pool. You know, in our day, almost any kid could go to a baseball game, almost, right? Almost all the seats, even the box seats, were generally affordable. I look at some of my tickets back from the 60s. $275, $375 for box seats. Now, it's a little bit different. We understand the currency, you know, what the value was. Today, the Yankees are talking about $2,500 for a front row seat in their new park. Regular field boxes are priced almost $200. Beer is $8 a bottle. I'm asking two of you two gentlemen who have both dealt in lifetime of finance with money, is this sustainable? Mr. Rosenberg here, is this sustainable outside of New York?
Well, outside of New York, perhaps not, and maybe even in New York, now that we're into what people are saying a recession, it's going to be hard to sell those tickets. But I know even at Madison Square Garden, where the Knicks play, and the front row is 2,500, they're sold out all the time. There's a lot of businessmen that pay for this and take clients and friends, and that's what the Yankees are trying to do with the new stadium and also the Mets.
I think that it becomes corporate marketing. Corporations will put up money to buy a luxury box. Then they have to buy tickets for every game. And so it becomes advertising or goodwill, whatever you want to call it, to promote business. But I can't visualize an average guy who, and I know a couple of them, they're paying $1.25 for their Yankee tickets, just went up to $250 a ticket, and he's got four tickets, so it's $1,000 a game.
That's a lot of
money. That's $81,000. He has to make, Mr. Accountant, $130,000
exactly.
To net 81.
Exactly.
Right.
Very good, Ralph.
So, you know, it's funny. I mean, this is it's interesting whether it can sustain itself. We know with the two new stadia in New York, they're going to sell out all the games. Everybody's going to want to be at the last game at Yankee Stadium, in the last season, the last game at Shea, and then the next 2 years, especially with the Yankees in this ballpark, will sell out. But they're not doing too well, both clubs. They're hovering around 500, and they you know, it's going to be expensive. You know, we're talking about in the light of $4 a gallon. I hope $4. It could be $5. High food prices, a recession looming, a continuing erosion of middle-class jobs. Can this pace of growth continue? Will it be a change in baseball, and is the era of mega salaries coming to an end? You two gentlemen, successful individuals, would you pay $1,000 to take three guests to Yankee Stadium or Shea Stadium? I mean,
It depends.
It depends on who it is.
Right.
I mean, if you want me to take, let's see. I hope my wife's not listening. Heather Locklear? Yeah, maybe.
Okay.
I'm teasing, but no, I would not.
Right.
I unless it were very close friends and the game was very, very important.
Right. Unfortunately, we've run out of time, and therefore I want to thank both our audience for listening in. Our special guest is Ralph Branken, original Boy of Summer, a member of the legendary Brooklyn Dodgers, and our panelists, Alan Rosenberg, for joining me on The Advocates. This is Richard Garfunkel signing off, and anybody who wants to hear this broadcast or any of the others on The Advocates can see it on my website, advocates-wvox.com. Thanks. Have a great day. It's beautiful out there. Thank you.
This is the flagship station of